Text 51551 today with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Tomorrow night, the former governor of Mountjoy Prison, John Lonergan, is to be honoured with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Irish Red Cross. The award recognises his contribution to society through his work in Irish prisons, which spans four decades. And John, the Governor Lonergan, joins me now. Lovely to see you, John.
Thank you very much, mate. Yeah.
Congratulations. What are your thoughts on the award?
I was very shocked, obviously. And I never expect any awards for anything because I always believe what I was doing was very simple and the normal thing to do anyway. But it's obviously nice to get such a recognition, and I suppose particularly to endorse the philosophy that I believed in, which was based on humanity and treating people with humanity, even in the most difficult situations, even the most difficult people. That I always believed that it was fundamentally about showing. I always believed, and I came to work on this and use it a lot. That if you treat people with respect and if you identify or help them to identify the humanity in themselves, then there's a big likelihood that they'll respect and recognise the humanity in other people, and they'll be less violent and less dismissive of people and less hurtful to other people. And most people think it's the opposite, but I always believe that, and it worked very much for me, and it still works to this day.
And I'll come back to that. I want to go first. You're a Tipperary man. Tell me about your family. Tell me about your parents and where you grew up.
I grew up in a little place called Tureen, a tiny little town down under the Galty Mountains in the parish of Banshee and Kilmyler. Banshee, in my day, when I was growing up, believe it or not, it was a very famous little place because of the association of Banshee with Canon Hayes, who was the founder of Wynton and the Theatre, who was a national and international figure at the time. And of course, he promoted that concept of community and equality, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. One of the first tasks he did when he came, when he was appointed as parish priest of Banshee in the 1950s, was to eliminate the practice that was there at that time of families with money being able to purchase a pew in the church and own it almost. And he said, in God's church, everybody shall be treated as equal. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge psychological demonstration of what equality really meant. So he was big into that.
Great.
And so that was a big influence. My parents were, my father would be classified nowadays as a handyman. He was handy in terms of doing things. And he worked most of his time in a house called Tureen Wood House, which is a big house up in the woods in Tureen. He worked there, and he also did other little jobs there, and we had a small bit of land as well. And my mother, naturally in those days, was full time at home. She used to refer to herself as a slave, and she was dead accurate. She was a slave. Because Miriam, people forget that in those days, you know, all the sort of modern technology and the modern equipment we have now, everything was done by hand.
Yeah, no washing machines.
No washing machine, gosh, no.
And there were eight children, right?
Eight of us, and no running water. So she had to go to the stream, as it was called that time, and bring the water, boil it over an open fire, cook, wash, everything. Rear eight children. I often said that I never ever experienced, and I don't believe she was ever on a holiday. Not alone that, but I never remember her being out of the house until she was in her mid-70s when she went to hospital, where she died. And up to that illness, she was never out of the house for a day. And many, many, many mothers were like her. And they are the people, of course, that I keep saying it. That generation of particularly women,
absolutely,
were amazing heroes. They were heroes,
yeah,
because the work and the hardship and the drudgery that they took on board. So it was and she was great. She had a great sense of humour, and she was a bit of a historian in the sense that when people wanted to know something about generations of people, you see, that those people knew everything about people. They could go back
generations,
and usually it was pretty negative and hurtful, and she'd tell you very quickly there was a time when they had nothing, and she was proud to say it to you. And people like her at that time. But anyway, she had a very humble life, but a very tough life in comparison to today.
Yeah, no, I think it's great to pay tribute to the women of that generation. Absolutely. Now, Liz, how did you end up going into the prison service?
She was just pure chance, Miriam. I knew nobody in prison, and I knew nobody that worked in prison. So I just responded to an advertisement in the daily newspapers at the time by the Civil Service Commission, Upper O'Connell Street, 45 Upper O'Connell Street. Some people, older listeners, will remember 45 Upper O'Connell Street because that's where everybody went to be interviewed for the civil service, the prison Service was under the control of the Civil Service at the time for recruitment. And I was successful and I was appointed to Limerick Prison on the 8th of March 1968, which is 51 years ago plus. And, you know, I'll never forget that first day, because my expectation going up was that, you know, all the bad people in Ireland would be in prison and all the good people would be outside of prison. And I'm honestly truthful about this. I wasn't there a week when I said, my God, that perception is definitely not accurate, because of what I met there were mainly social misfits, believe it or not. The equivalent at the time of the people who often ended up in county homes, which were in every county, where there were hospitals that really facilitated the elderly and the broken people of that time. And lots of the people I met in prison at that time were fed into that category rather than being criminal. People with disability, disability wasn't recognised at all. And people with mental illness, quite a huge number of them had serious mental illness. So there was a lot of social issues combined in, and I decided at that time that prisons were used as a dumping ground for social misfits. And that wasn't popular to say that, but it was the reality. And so that was a big eye-opener, really.
And actually, that must have formed you then, John, did it? You know, going around to different prisons, because you were among the first people to start looking at where the people in prisons came from, what the origins were behind their offending.
Yes.
You saw them as individuals, as human beings.
You know, I think I was appointed to be governor of Mountjoy in 1984, and honestly, that was one of the first questions that I was asking. Why are people in prison? Rather than, and we didn't know. And that was the first piece of decent research that was done on that whole area was done in 1986 by the late Dr. Paul O'Mahony. Actually, Miriam, I did a piece of research myself when I was appointed Governor Mountjoy in 1984-85. I interviewed 440 prisoners myself and had all this questionnaire drawn up. I interviewed it myself and then got it analysed by a wonderful lady. I met her since, Marie Brady. She was in the IPA at the time, and she facilitated the analysing of the research. And it found a huge amount of stuff. And it was published and leaked. And it was dismissed by the officialdom at the time. He's not a researcher. So you have to think on your feet. And I said, right, I'm not a researcher, but I'll get a researcher. And a researcher will prove what I was after doing originally was true. And Dr. Paul O'Mahony came in at the time. He was a research psychologist in the Department of Justice. And he actually told me, he said, you killed yourself. There was no need to do 400. And he had a different, more scientific way of doing it. But he found some amazing information. Like that 75% of all Dublin-born prisoners came from six tiny little geographical areas in Dublin. And the sad thing, Miriam, is
you told me that years ago.
It's still the case today.
That statistic again.
The statistic is that he found that 75% of Dublin-born prisoners, he asked everyone, where were you born? And if they said Dublin, then he asked them, where in Dublin? And six tiny little geographical areas showed that six tiny geographical areas were the born places of 75% of all Dublin-born people.
So,
and they're not postal districts now. They're tiny little geographical areas like the inner city. But you're not talking about all the inner city, north or south. You're talking about a big portion of Dublin 8, but not all of Dublin.
So is that, John, is that deprivation and or habit that new generations see their fathers and grandfathers? I mean, what is the cause of that? Or is it a mixture of both?
It's mainly culture, which we don't often recognise as having the impact it has. There's all different types of culture in Ireland, and it's only a small little country, but in poor, socially deprived areas. You'd have to go and see them, first of all, because the physical makeup of these areas alone is depressing. I've been campaigning a little bit with supporting the people of Dublin East around open spaces and green space and recreation and sporting facilities for children, where over 50,000 children don't have one square metre of green space, really, to play and to recreate in. And if you create that type of culture and environment, isn't it inevitable that children will be very much influenced? But I think, Miriam, the other thing that was really, really significant as well, he looked at education. And because education is such a fundamental part of our development, and only 6% of all the prisoners in Mountjoy at that time, 600 to 700 of them, only 6% had stayed in education after 16 years of age. So 94% were out of education by 60, but 57% had dropped out by 15. So if you come from a poor area and if you're poorly educated, well, then you will definitely won't reach your potential. So isn't it almost inevitable? And of course, then drugs, you know, deprivation, the culture, poor education, and what comes next? Drugs. So, and that's why Mount Joy was also so much associated with
drugs. I'm also conscious as well, Donna, people listening this morning who maybe, you know, have suffered either violent crimes or someone in their family or close to them have been assaulted, murdered or serious crimes, and they will think maybe you're being too benign towards violent prisoners, that in other words they will say they're in prison because they are a danger to me and my family.
Miriam, they're two completely different things. I laboured all my life with the media and trying to get this message over to the public. There's a massive difference between making excuses for people who commit crime and trying to understand the root causes. And what I was trying to say was, if we can find the root causes and if we can work at that, there's a great chance that we will reduce the number of victims in the first place. Because if a person doesn't commit a crime, you won't have a victim. There is no excuse, irrespective of the background, when a person commits a crime, especially a violent crime, against another human being, there are no excuses. I have never made an excuse. I suppose one other bit of interest to your listeners would be the Mount Joy research had an influence, at least, on the development of the 2001 Children Act. Because, again, another statistic he found, that 75% of adults in Mount Joy had been in detention as children. And, of course, we had a horrible record of putting children into detention over the centuries. And we know the cost now. And they introduced the 2001 Children Act with the whole philosophy that we early intervention and early prevention. We have the lowest number of young people in custody and detention ever in the history of the state at the current time, directly as a result of that new policy. So the signs then are good, that if we don't put in children in the first place, we don't give them criminal convictions, then there's a likelihood that our actual prison population will drop as well.
Do we do enough in terms of rehabilitation, John, you know, of prisoners and helping them when they come out to reintegrate? Because there's so much, you know, people who offend, re-offend. We know that.
No, we don't. Of course we don't. We have very few resources really into aftercare. We probably have the poorest of most countries in terms of resource for aftercare. Now, that's not dismissing some of the lovely little projects that are there. And around the country, in Cork and Limerick and Dublin, there are little projects that are doing tremendous work in trying to integrate, but they are tiny in comparison to the overall thing. And the other problem is that as we have identified where the most of them come from, inevitably they go back there. And they're the very places where they shouldn't be really, because they're immediately connected back into the same culture again. The same peer influence, the same peer pressure, and of course, a criminal conviction is bad. A prison and criminal conviction is very, very damaging in terms of your future prospects, in terms of travel, in terms of opportunity, and of course, the culture. If you know people in prison, you're likely to reconnect with them when you go back into your community again. And what does that do? It helps you to stay in the whole criminal field.
You commented recently regarding the sentencing of Boy A and Boy B in the Anna Creagel case. You said they've committed an evil crime, but they are not evil. Explain your thoughts on that, John.
Oh, they're not evil. No, I don't. I was often asked that when I was in Mount Joy. Did you meet evil people? And I said, I met several people who had committed evil crimes, but I never met a totally evil person, which I didn't. There's humanity in everybody. I don't care. It might be their mothers, it might be their children, it might be whatever the circumstances. But I don't believe those boys are evil. But I do believe they have committed a horrendously evil act. And I do believe, by the way, as well, that I'm not very happy at the moment in the way that society in general have responded to that, because I haven't seen any leadership in government in particular, and those who should be leading to put resources into looking at why. Why is this happening? There's a trend out there now where there's an awful lot of violence, an awful lot of a knife crime, a huge amount of young people, almost a trend to have a knife. Have a penknife or have a knife on your person, and that's a very bad indicator. So I think we do need to use this case to educate ourselves, and it's not good enough for some minister like Josefa
Madigan,
Minister for Culture, to say it's up to parents and it's up to teachers. Government must lead, and they must give resources to research to look at the impact of screens and social media and modern technology on the lives of young people. We don't know yet, and the one alarming thing is we're putting very little resources into monitoring it and having an overall overview of the damage or the potential damage.
Now, Slopping Out is in the news this week, of course, with an award to a former prisoner. He was awarded $7,500 in damages for having to slop out. Do you think that will mean a raft of similar claims?
The judges were very conscious of that, and they said it shouldn't be. Believe it or not, Miriam, I'm not very sympathetic at all for that particular grievance. And I was asked a few times, would I give evidence? And I said no.
Because Why are you not sympathetic?
I'm not, because I can go back long enough where slopping out, in inverted commas, was a normal part of life for most people. You know, we now think in 2019 that everyone had integral sanitation in their homes and in hospitals and everywhere. There weren't, actually. Quite a number of it. The chamber pot was a very normal piece of furniture in the old days.
But not in recent decades.
No, I know, Miriam. Mm. I know. But I just think, while I always thought it was a very, I suppose, crude thing, and I think that wasn't very nice, an unpleasant thing. But I think I have to balance it out. And I think of people, sick people, spending 2 or 3 days on a trolley in a hospital. What about their dignity? They're sick people. I'm all in favour of integral sanitation. I believe that integral sanitation is desirable, but I must say that I'm sceptical about the amount of damage that's done to somebody who has to slop out. I think the judge recognised some of that, but as a trend, I certainly wouldn't be a supporter of it.
You retired from being the governor back in 2010. You're still really involved, John, in trying to educate and inform. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, I'm lucky enough to be able yet to go around schools and colleges and voluntary communities and communities themselves. And the message I have, I suppose, is all the time to try and prevent things happening rather than the opposite and reacting to them. And for young people especially, and particularly maybe in my case, boys in particular, I find it very useful to be able to go and to be able to tell them the reality of. Young boys particularly are not very good at recognising the consequences of behaviour. And moments of madness are responsible for quite a number of people ending up in prison. People doing things without thinking and without realising the consequences. So I suppose being able to talk to them, and most people are fascinated with prison. So I'm able to use that experience of prison as the sort
are
of catalyst.
Are they sad places?
Oh, very depressing places, of course, Miriam. Yeah, very depressing places and very damaging psychologically and mentally to people as well, especially longer term. If you're serving anything over what I consider a long sentence, 5 years long, over that, spending 18, 19 hours locked up in a cell. Nowadays, 50% roughly have to share cells, something that's not recognised at all. For me, a far more serious thing than slopping out, to have to live with somebody 24 hours, 7 days a week. So prisons are depressing places. And anybody who would be happy in prison, there's something seriously wrong with them.
Finally, briefly, throughout your long career, John, what's the biggest change you've seen in prisons? Have they improved?
The biggest single change would be medical services, coming from zero almost when I started off to excellent medical service now, both physical and mental services have improved dramatically. That's the biggest single factor that has improved. And I suppose the side that has stayed static or gone backwards is what I said, the doubling up. When I was a young member of staff in Limerick in 1968, if you allow two prisoners into a single cell, you'd be sacked. And nowadays we're doing it to the extent that 50% of the prison population are officially sharing cells.
Well, look, John Lonergan, congratulations again on your Lifetime Achievement Award. Best of luck at the Irish Red Cross Humanitarian Awards tomorrow night. So well deserved. After the break, Evelyn O'Rourke is going to be reporting on the Youth Climate Assembly up at the Dáil.
Today with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.